You are listening to the Screenfish Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Norton. This week on the show, we welcome podcaster David Peck, host of Face to Face Live, and Screenfisher Julie Levac, as we talk about Christopher Nolan's latest film, Dunkirk. Dunkirk has been a hit at the box office and with critics, yet it remains particularly divisive in terms of its tone. Is the film more hopeful? Or is it a darker look at the tragedy of war? Or is it both? We talk about this and much more. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Welcome to the podcast. We are so excited this week to talk about Christopher Nolan's latest film, Dunkirk. It's a look inside one of the seminal battles in World War II and stars Kenneth Branagh, Tom Hardy, and even Harry Styles. But before we get into the film, I would like to welcome our two guests this week. We're so excited to have with us for the first time, podcaster David Peck. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me.
We're so glad you could be here. David is the host of Face to Face.
Face to Face is it. Facetofacelive.ca is where you can find it.
Great. And of course, welcome back to Julie Levac, one of our Screenfish team. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to apologize in advance. I do have a bit of a cold. Just ignore my voice.
It's great to have you both on. We're very excited to talk about this film, which has gotten rave reviews and actually been a solid hit in the box office. But before we do, just a reminder to all of you that are listening that spoilers are fair game. As we talk about the film and talk about its issues, we want to be able to talk about instances and that are meaningful or have messages for us. And if that's an issue for you, feel free to pause here and see the film come back. But otherwise, we want to proceed and talk about the film as thoroughly as possible. So let's just jump in. Guys, Dunkirk, what did you think?
I was blown away. I've seen it twice. I'm probably going to go back. I think that, Steve, if you didn't see it in 70 millimeter IMAX, I don't know that if I can ever speak to you again. That's kind of how I feel about this one.
I watched it on my cell phone. Is that a problem?
that's a bit of a problem for me. I think Christopher Nolan might be a little concerned.
So what?
I thought it was remarkable. I was pulled in from the first frame. As Hollywood Reporter says, it calls it a stunning victory. And I was immersed. I was engrossed. I had tears in my eyes at several points. Second viewing was better. It was richer. I think even on the second viewing, it pulled me in even more. And I was fighting them on the beaches.
Mm. So what is it about it that you connected with so deeply? Those are strong reviews.
Yeah, it's true. Can you tell that I enjoyed it? And Julie, can you tell that I'm fairly passionate about this film?
Yeah, I'm kind of loving it. I want to go see it a second time now.
Yeah, I'm going again for a third time because I think Nolan said in an interview that 70 millimeter might be the greatest argument against watching a movie on Netflix, and I think he's absolutely right. I mean, just the way, you know, having access to seeing what the vision of the director really was, I think is something that's probably not going to come along again in the really near future from a 70 millimeter perspective. But maybe I'll be wrong on that, and they're starting to outfit more theaters with this kind of technology. I certainly hope so. But for me, the second time around, Steve, Julie, it was really more about. What I really took from it was obviously the story. It's engrossing. It's suspenseful. It's highly entertaining. But it's a deeply hopeful story. And what I found about it was, you know, just this, the power of one, the individual choice matters, and it matters more, you know, than we know. And it plays into this sense of a collective whole, and everything we do affects somebody else. And it just comes out in such a significant way in this film, in a beautiful way, but also just really in a really compelling way as well. Mm. The sound, the lighting, the cinematography. Yeah, stunning. Can you tell I liked it?
It's not really coming through.
too big.
Oh man, maybe tomorrow we could do this again, and I'll tell you how I really think.
Oh man, you're going to come out of it the third time and say, "What was I thinking?" That movie. No,
That's right. So second time I saw it with Elizabeth, my wife, and we're coming out, and woman in front with I don't know who it was, friend, partner, husband, I'm not sure. She said, "So what do you think?" It was okay. I think for the first time in my life I wanted to actually throttle somebody.
Whoa. Yeah. Well, man, Julie, I really hope that you're prepared, because I'm going to ask you what you think. And
oh, it was the worst movie ever. I'm just kidding.
Quite possibly.
David's going to dive through Skype, and he's.
Oh yeah, the conversation is done now.
Yeah.
It was a stunning film. I mean, we've got Christopher Nolan here. We're talking Dark Knight trilogy, Inception. I had some high expectations going into it. Didn't disappoint. I knew right from the first gunfire scene that it was something special. First of all, I almost went deaf, but that's fine. I saw it in IMAX, so the sound was incredible. But there was something about the sound of the gunfire in that first scene. It wasn't the stereotypical action movie gunfire. It sounded real. Keeping in mind, I don't have a lot of gunfire experience in real life, but it sounded like I was there. And I knew right from then, like, this is epic.
Yeah, you know, when I came out of it, the first thought I had was that in some ways Hans Zimmer deserves as much credit as Nolan does in terms of this. You know, think about, because the sound, now I know he wasn't doing the sound effects, but he's doing the score, but it really is in your eardrums and in your face from the very beginning. I just can't imagine it with a different soundtrack.
You know, I don't know that I remember seeing a film where I was so drawn in so quickly. And I don't know if that had to do with my own expectations going in, or as you said, Julie, you know, coming out almost deaf. I mean, it was loud, you know. I actually heard somebody say that, I think, again, it was an interview or somebody telling me about an interview that a soldier who was actually at Dunkirk said the film's louder than it was at Dunkirk, which, you know, is probably, you know, probably a fair comment, I would imagine. But I was drawn in from the get-go, and I think there, for a variety of reasons, but I think it's a real testament to the way he's made the film. I mean, even the water coming out of the hose that I forget the name of the character, but kind of the what's his name? Come on. We don't really hear a lot of names in this film, do we, Steve?
No. I mean,
we don't see the enemy. Right? I mean, it's so interesting. Is it Tommy? I can't think of the main character. I think it's Tommy. Anyway, he reaches down to get a drink out of a hose. And I mean, even the water, I mean, the sound is just stunning. Never, you know, and the score.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, the ticking, the constant ticking, that sense of urgency, it's just so palpable. It's, yeah. Did I say that it was a remarkable film?
I'm not getting the sense you really liked it very much. Actually, I'm not really seeing that. You know, you're going to hate me because I didn't see it in IMAX. I intended to. And the timing for me to actually make sure that I got it in, it only worked in a regular, it's just standard theater. But I will say that I felt like I was missing out on something. I admit that. You know, working with the youth, back in March, we ended up, I took some of the boys to see Kong Skull Island, just on a whim, take some of the teens to see a ridiculous movie, we'll have some laughs, whatever, and it was in IMAX. And I saw the trailer for Dunkirk, and I'd seen trailers for Dunkirk before, and I thought it looked okay. Then I saw it in IMAX, and I felt overwhelmed, and that was in the trailer. So I knew that I was missing out on something the way that I watched the film in terms of just visually, the sheer scope. And of course, even that shot of all the soldiers standing on the bridge and as they all duck down.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah.
I really look forward to the Blu-ray and the making of featurettes, because I want to know how many live extras Nolan actually uses, because I know he has a penchant for non-CGI. Like, he uses CGI, but sparingly. He tries to go as conventional as possible. That's the way he likes to shoot. And one of the things I thought as I was watching the film is if they had as many extras as they seem to have had, you know, this is rivaling Gone with the Wind.
Wow. Right.
So it can't be. It was unbelievable, the sheer scope of the film, that from the first moment, really. But I say but because it was one of those films that I found it was a great film. It was really well made, and I could tell it, but it took me a while. Now, this is why I need a second viewing. It took me a while to step in, not to the battle sequences, but to how he told his story. I'm not saying it was confusing, but because it isn't. And I, you know, people said that Inception was confusing, and I didn't think it was confusing at all. But it sort of took me a while to step into his rhythm. Once I stepped into his rhythm, I was all in.
Do you mean, Steve, the way that he's playing with time in this film? Or?
Yeah, I mean the way he's playing with time. It was interesting because, you know, it opens, of course, with them saying, on the land, 1 week, on the sea, 1 day, in the air, 1 hour. It was truly a unique story for him to tell. It had some of the Nolanisms, if you will, like, you know, had some of his friends that were in it that he keeps in. And he does like to do time shifting. Like, you look at films like Memento and, of course, Inception and even The Prestige. He likes to play with time very, very much. But the way he told this story, it just took me a few minutes. I would say it took me about 15, 20 minutes to really see, to really understand how he's going. And I think the reason it was, and this is foolish, I admit, is quite simply the fact that I've heard it compared so frequently to Saving Private Ryan, which is a terrible comparison, having seen the film. I like, Julie, that you called it a unique vision, because every other war movie that I have ever seen sort of follows a straight-up narrative. And even Nolan's films usually focus in on one great hero or somebody who will stand in the front. And this one, it just sort of focuses on everybody at once. You know, we mentioned about the names, but I was waiting for the backstory because that's what I was expecting. Oh, well, they're throwing us into the action, but they're going to tell us how we got there. But they never do. And that's not a criticism at all.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. As soon as I walked out of the movie, I was like, you know what? It's fascinating how all characters in that movie were equal. No one character stood out more than another. There was not more spotlight on that main character. He was on the same level as everybody else. You know, they didn't give more screen time to Harry Styles or Tom Hardy. Like, it was all very team-oriented.
Well, you know, one of the things, I think you're absolutely right, and the thing that really struck me, you're going to have to see it again, by the way, Steve.
I will. I want to see it in IMAX.
I started to take notes on the first viewing, and I just went, you know what? No way. I'm done. That's just, it's disrespectful. It's disrespectful to Christopher Nolan. It's disrespectful to the story and to the people that's lives who were affected, you know, as he says at the end of the film at Dunkirk. So I closed the book, and I immersed myself, and thankfully I was able to do it. This film for me is about ordinary people doing really extraordinary things. And this is where the hope really comes through. And it came through more the second time. War is the most insane, absurd thing imaginable.
Yeah.
The lineups on the beach, those sweeping shots, what appears to be these guys walking towards the beach and reading flyers that are dropping around them, and then sniper fire out of nowhere. And I think that's part of the reason why we don't know their names. And Julie, like you say, the nobody's really a star in this film, right? I mean, Kenneth Branagh doesn't get a lot of screen time even. And it's really quite remarkable how this is about the common, mostly men and some women doing really extraordinary things, saving other lives, saving themselves, obviously a part of a much bigger whole, as we find out later in not only in the film but in life as well, in the history of World War II.
Yeah, well, that was one of the things that I really fascinated with. And again, I think it goes back to just what I was used to in terms of what I see in a war film, is because you're right, there's no names. I mean, there are names in some ways, but they're almost meaningless. the only name that we get beat over the head with is George.
Right.
Yes.
There is this one kid who's not even a soldier who ends up on Mark Rylance's boat as they're crossing the channel. You know, George, like they keep saying it over and over again, like this kid. But the rest of the soldiers, the ones in the battle, they're not saying, hey, what company are you from? You know, what are you doing, Sergeant Jeffries or whatever? They're not doing any of those things. In fact, it was interesting, too, because I think there's a scene where after the boat sinks, after the first boat really sinks and they three of them end up on the shore and a company is marching and they're marching towards the boat that has been, you know, on land. And they just sort of join the troop. And right, I thought to myself, right, you know, there's no, hey, you know, where are you from? They just sort of, all right, where are you going? We're going to this boat. All right, we're joining you. And there's this sense of community. And by eliminating most of the names of the characters, you really get a sense for the fact that every individual matters.
Right.
That was one of the things that I really, really saw there is that, like you said, is that there was nobody has any real, nobody is more important than the other people. And I like that you said,
do you remember on the dock? I don't know if you remember because you didn't see it in 70 millimeter, but there's a tracking shot where the two characters are running right near the beginning of the film. They're running they're pretending to be, medics running the stretcher out along the dock. And there's a tracking shot and it sort of follows all the rifles that are lined up on the dock.
Mm.
I don't know if that rings a bell or not.
Yes, but absolutely.
Yeah. Second viewing for me was just each one of these was at one time held by one of these guys. Mm. This is just, you know, it's kind of like the domino effect almost. They're all waiting to fall. There's so many little bits of business in this film about the bullet holes that start to appear in the boat.
Yeah.
The sniper practice from the, you know, the other soldier, the enemy soldier that's just goofing around, but having such an impact on these guys' lives inside the boat that he doesn't even know they even exist. And then one by one, these holes just open up. And I was just really struck the second time around, more so by even George's role. The decision, Steve, Julie, the decision that he makes, he just jumps in the boat.
Yeah.
I love George's character.
I know. Isn't it remarkable, too?
But I'm so confused by it because I feel like there's so much more there about George that I just haven't grasped yet. The fact that he jumps on the boat, like you mentioned, to help when he didn't have to, and he didn't even really know what he was getting into.
That's right.
I find it interesting. I'm like, why was he killed? Why did they make such a big deal out of him? I feel like they could very well have omitted him from the story altogether, still maintain the integrity, but he's there for a reason. I can't place my finger on it. What are they trying to tell us with him?
Well, I feel like with him, you've seen Schindler's List. Have you guys seen Schindler's List?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
for sure. In high school,
pretty sure I saw that in 70 millimeter too.
Oh man, I can't. I'm not going to get around this.
I'm going to be bringing this up for quite some time.
I next time I see Despicable Me, I'm going to see it in 70 millimeter. In Schindler's List, the thing that everybody was talking about was the girl in pink. Mm. You know, the black and white film, and the one of the strongest memories I have is the girl in pink, and it's just this child. She doesn't have a line, but she's the only color in the entire film, and she stands out. And I felt like George was kind of that in this film. Mm. You see, by giving him a name, they give him a story. And Julie, I think that that's a great question. There's lots of reasons that we don't understand about his character, but we know that his character matters, and a lot of that has to do with the fact he has a name. And that stands out. But so with the way that Nolan writes and shoots this film, the thing that really struck me was I think that George stood in for all 400,000 or 300,000 soldiers. You know, we don't need to know all of their names, but we know one name. And because they sort of have this balance of every person matters. And here's your example is George.
Well, George matters, but he's playing a part in this massive operation, this massive rescue operation. Each one of these soldiers is playing their own part. Kenneth Branagh is playing his own part. At the end of the film, he's staying, and what's he staying for? He's going to stay for the French. Hmm. You know, I mean, that shot that you talked about earlier on, Steve, where it's, and again, it's a stunning shot of all the soldiers on the dock and the one soldier looking up into the sky as the I don't know if it's a Stuka dive bomber or what it is, and then slowly they all turn and they look. Yeah. I mean, it's just breathtaking, and it's so beautifully put together. Yet each individual matters, but we are in fact all in this together. And so George makes this crazy last minute decision, jumps in the boat without even really thinking, but it's going to affect the rest of his life, right? And it does in fact lead to him having his life, you know, ending his life. But he said, "What? It's so beautiful. I tears in my eyes, man." Mm. What does he say? Best thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
Best thing I've ever done just before he dies.
Yeah.
And that's just, it's astounding.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting too, because for a guy like George, I love, David, the fact that you brought up that you never see a German in this movie. You never see anyone from the German side. There's no story to the Germans. They're just this oppositional evil. And a guy like George, he doesn't know what he's in for. He's never seen what war looks like, but he says, well, you're going to go help some people? Okay, let me go with you. And there is that incredible strength in his decision that he doesn't even really realize, because I think they say he's like 15 years old or something. I mean,
Well, to me, you know what, Steve? To me, again, I'm gonna play on the hope. I'm gonna play the hope card again.
Go for it.
George is hopeful.
Yeah.
He hops in the boat, and what does he say? I might be useful, sir. That's his answer.
That's true.
So innocent.
He's so innocent, and yet he still thinks he can. You know, he can make a difference. He's going to make a difference. He's a part of this as well. I mean, talk about community, right? I mean, and that end scene when Branagh picks up the binoculars and looks out on the sea and realizes that all these ships are coming in to, you know, that people are banding together and clearly making this significant difference as again, the small part to the whole. It's just, again, it's just a remarkable reminder to us all that we've all got our parts to play. And I saw it as a real existential kind of story, film, offering, whatever you want to call that, you know, all these decisions matter, freedom, choice, responsibility. It comes down to, you know, how many times in the film, actually, the decisions, that decision that Tom Hardy's character makes, yes, I will go after the bomber, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I was in anguish while he was trying to decide, because his gas is running out, and ultimately that affects everything for him. You know, at the end of the film, which, by the way, we got to talk about, and again on the second viewing, was just so beautiful and such a hopeful ending. I saw it as a much darker film the first time.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm intrigued by you saying it's a hopeful ending, because I guess it depends on who those guys are that grab him at the end of that film, because
pretty sure it's the enemy. It's the closest we get to the enemy in the whole film. We don't even see the silhouettes of pilots in the cockpits of planes, right? It's just so detached. The enemy is so detached from us, so disinterested.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, it's funny when you look at the idea of hope in this film. They talk about it. The word is repeated so often, and that's significant in a film that has very little actual dialogue.
Yes,
Nolan's a talker.
He really is. Yeah.
Nolan's that guy who likes to, you know, he likes the grand speeches and the big moments. And I think there's less dialogue in here than there is than Schwarzenegger says in Terminator 2. Like this.
Right. There's less dialogue than in a Bertolucci film, and that's saying a great deal.
You see Branagh's character. One of the things they keep saying throughout the film is that I can almost see it.
Yeah,
you know, it just seems like everything is out of reach for them. I felt like these guys just kept getting kicked in the groin. Like, you know,
Well, isn't that though what hope is really about? Hope is on the other side, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a great line, and I can't think of. I think it's Elizabeth Barrett Browning, I think, who said, "If a man's reach does not exceed his grasp, then what's a heaven for?"
Mm.
So if you're not reaching out beyond, then you're not really, I guess, cutting it in a sense. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, another tearjerker of a scene in a sense when, yeah, what can you almost see? Oh, well, that's my family. That's where life actually matters, right? That's where meaning lives, on the other side of the channel, which is what, 20 miles away? Which is, again, also for me, just a reminder of the absurdity of war. I don't know about you guys, but I thought this was the true definition of a horror film. The first time I saw it, that's how I just, wow, I don't ever want to go to a war. I don't ever want to see a war. This is horrifying.
Yeah,
I can understand that for sure. There's something about true stories, especially stories about things like war. It's just, it's more terrifying because you know that it happened and it can happen again and it can happen to you and your family. And it's just incredible.
There's something intensely personal about this film for me, and I don't know that I've landed on it quite yet. But I think maybe I'm going to have to reflect on George a little bit more, but maybe it's his character. I found it harder to watch this the second time around, that whole sequence, that whole, you know, sort of subtext of the story itself.
I think that George, now that I'm thinking more about it and we're talking about it, he seems to almost represent how the war strips people of their innocence. Do you know what I mean? Because that's exactly what happened. He was so innocent and he just said, yeah, let's go. Like, I can help. But that's just like, it's not even, he had no clue. And it just ate him up.
The ending in some ways was the most powerful part for me. And that's just because of when they land, when they all get off. There were some fascinating character moments that happen in the last 10 minutes of this film that you don't get throughout the rest of the film. And that's not a shot at anything in the rest of the film. It's just simply that the rest of the film really isn't about character development. It's about get these guys home. But you look at Harry Styles' character, and I don't even know his name, so, you know, it's Harry Styles. But there are several times in the last 10 minutes where he makes comments about, did we let you down? We failed. And that to me was a really poignant moment because, you know, on paper, they did. You know, if you're looking at it strictly, if you're looking at it strictly from a strategic perspective, you could make that argument, but it really showed that that there wasn't a failure per se, but that's what the emphasis was, is his fear is that, you know, we've given so much, but we didn't do enough. And when they come back and everybody's just thanking them and so thrilled that they made it home alive, there's this value for them as people that really was striking. And the other moment that hit me between the eyes was as they're all coming off the boat and the pilot, Tom Hardy's, you know, wingman, if you will, his Iceman, is standing there. And one of the guys from the other platoons looks at him and says, where were you in the midst of all this? Of course he's been on the boat with Mark Rylance, and Mark Rylance walks up to him and he says, it doesn't matter if they know where you were. And he points to the guys that did know. And he said, those guys knew where you were. And it just made me think of about the stories that get lost and just the emotional power that these guys are investing in these scenarios. You know, you see that could have been an absolutely soul-crushing moment for him to think, again, I've failed somehow because we didn't, quote, win the day.
Right.
But winning the day and the end, at the end of the day, winning the day is really about life and survival and that to me was really, really poignant. And again, points to the power of the individual story. It didn't matter that the people that didn't know where he were, it didn't matter that some guys didn't know what he was doing because he was still doing what he had to do. And that mattered. And everything that every one of them did mattered. And it was a successful mission. They may not have pushed back the Germans like they'd hoped, but it was successful because the mission was survival.
Churchill called it a colossal military disaster, I think is the direct quote. And I think, you know, what's interesting about the way Nolan brings Churchill in, I think it's fabulous that he's got and I forget his name again, but I think it's Tommy, his character reading Churchill's speeches. We hear Churchill's speech through the voice and the character of this ordinary private in the army.
That was fascinating, for sure.
Right, right, Julie. To your earlier point, to sort of come back full circle to that, that ordinary aspect of we don't see their faces. There's no real star power, etc. Same with Churchill. We don't see him in front of a podium smoking a cigar in front of the House of Commons. We get to hear it through this ordinary private's eyes. Voice. Yeah, I think for me, Steve, that you know the you said it's interesting that you saw the end of the film as hope. I mean, the plane is just kind of a, to me, kind of a, ironically for me, it's a hopeful metaphor, but the way that it's shot with the sunshine and Zimmer's score, we're going to live to fight another day. And yeah. I mean, as we know, history shows that they did. I mean, Churchill wanted 35 to 40,000 people off the beach. They got close to 350,000 off the beach. That's incredible. Right. So for me, that I think that's why I saw it more as this hopeful story ultimately in the end. I mean, it's also a real paradox because it is utterly madness. I mean, it's just madness. It's absurd.
Oh, yeah.
This thing called war is just so absurd.
Yeah. Yeah. It, you know, it's interesting, you know, going back to the idea of hope, too, that hope really lies in the form of community in the film. That's why I was so fascinated by the tension. There seemed to be a great tension between every individual matters, but we all need each other. So there was this individual community.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
You know, and you're
well, even Mark Rylance's character, when they're going to get the guy that you were just talking about in the Spitfire who goes down, you know, at the end of the film that you were just talking about, the son doesn't want to go and get him. Dad, it's a waste of time. We didn't see a parachute. He must be dead.
Yeah.
And Rylance's character, no, he might be alive. We might be able to save him. I mean, that's hope. That's hope in action. And And then the whole, that whole sort of domino effect again of how all these individuals end up affecting, you know, other lives. Speaks to that greater sense of community as a whole.
I will say, though, just to cut in, Mark Rylance's character, it's interesting how you were talking about how he was saying no, like he could still be alive, go get him. There's obviously some sort of history there with him, and he's been involved in war before. He knows the drill, and he, you could just sort of tell, like he remains pretty calm throughout the whole thing, but there are a few little, he plays it really well. There are a few things that he does, the way that he says it, his face, where you could tell that he's got a little bit of damage, you know, from whatever it was that he experienced. And although I sort of was interested to know a little bit more about his past, I think it was interesting that they left it sort of mysterious and just said, no, we're here to do this job. It's not about me. It's not about what I've been through. It's about these guys that are out there right now.
But he's also one of the only characters that gets a bit of backstory because it's his son that reveals to, I believe it's the pilot, that his older brother died in the war earlier on that year, I think it is. It was recently. No other character has anything told about them. I don't even think we find out anything about George other than the fact that he's a kid who gets on the boat.
Well, we also don't really get any context about what's going on at Dunkirk other than they're trapped on this beach. You know, the establishing shots are these guys walking down the street, you know, and I think clearly very intentional. And I think that's, yeah, absolutely. But you're right. His character gets a little bit more context. Yeah. The son died, I think, 5 days into the war.
Yes.
Flying Hurricanes, wasn't flying Spitfires. I think he was flying Hurricanes. I think that's the line. Yeah. Again, this real beautiful tension between, you know, that sense of hope, I suppose, and that absurdity of how insane this thing called war really is.
Yeah.
I wonder what a true, and whatever that means, a true pacifist. I'm a hope so pacifist. I mean, I wonder what a true pacifist would say about this film. You know, kind of and I watched actually Hacksaw Ridge recently as well, so it was interesting to kind of get that kind of contrast between the two the two stories and the two, I mean, they're both anti-war films, right? So, I mean, I certainly saw Dunkirk as an anti-war film, that's for sure.
But the interesting thing about Hacksaw Ridge is, again, that highlights the individual above all else. Because that particular film just focuses on, I can't think of his name, but Andrew Garfield's character as right. The one who essentially wins them the battle. You know, it's one person, it becomes one person's fight. And, you know, again, you're right, it's an anti-war film. But I'm always interested in the balance of that when you look at a war film, because it's a film about war, and yet we argue that it's an anti-war film. And where that the balance is in the air, because ultimately in the end of the day, Christopher Nolan has made a powerful film, and it's almost an art house film in some ways, but it's making a lot of money. And are people seeing it because it's powerful, or are people seeing it because it's got great action set pieces? Yeah, I'm always intrigued by that.
Or it's mysteriously entertaining.
Yeah.
And I think it is entertaining, and I think deeply suspenseful on all those things. But I think there's a few other things going on there as well. It's the kind of film that I believe, you know, I would think, because we've had this conversation, hopefully we'll continue to reflect on this and refer back to it. But it's one of those films that sits. I forget where I read it, but some people are calling it an impressionistic masterpiece. I mean, that's the direct quote I read recently. So, will Nolan go down to be one of the greatest filmmakers of our time? I'm inclined to think he will.
Well, I think this is certainly his most Oscar-friendly movie.
Oh, yeah. It's true. And isn't it interesting that he releases it in July and not kind of later in the season, which is typically when it seems like most of the Oscar fare gets released?
Yeah, it's true. I would argue that's the Nolan factor, you know, because if you look at where he's released most of his films, it's mid-July.
Is that right? Oh, yeah. Is that a blockbuster fair?
Yeah, he seems to favor, well, you look at the films he's done, and I'm not sure when Inception was released. I know Dark Knight was late July. Batman Begins, I think, was late June. Because his name carries, Inception was certainly a summer film, I think. Now I'm questioning myself. But right, Nolan's name carries with it a certain sweeping epic. But looking back at his films, they're almost all sci-fi or fantasy in some way.
Right.
So it's interesting for him to go, I'd like to say he goes a complete 180, but he doesn't. As I said before, there's certainly the Nolanisms in this film. Although I did hear at one point that he actually wanted, you know, once he had a sense of where he wanted the movie to go, that he actually just wanted to improv it, which is wildly different than anything he's ever done before. Because again,
you mean with no script?
That's what I was hearing, is that he was toying with the idea of just sort of setting up the set pieces and letting it go. He knew exactly what he wanted to do with his scenes, but, you know,
I believe that's how Mike Leigh does a lot of his films, and I'm sure there are others out there. Terrence Malick, I would think, probably uses that. In fact, I'm pretty sure he does that approach as well. Sort of set up the context, get a little bit of some sort of emotional space happening, whatever that means, on set, and then let the actors go.
Yeah, but Nolan doesn't do that. That's what I mean. They asked him, they said, so are you going to do more films that are like this with less dialogue? And he said, we're going to go back to dialogue.
So here's a question for you. The guy who takes off his backpack, drops his rifle, drops his helmet on the sand and walks into the ocean, is he committing suicide or is he swimming across the channel?
Oh, man. That's a tough one.
I'm going to let Julie answer that.
I honestly am not sure. My very first thought was he was committing suicide. But the way that he dove into the water, it didn't seem like I'm just going to go under.
Right.
He seemed to go forward. So it's, I don't know, maybe it's one of those things that Christopher Nolan just wanted us to think about. And I think it does sort of speak to the mindset of these men and what emotionally they're going through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'd never even considered it. I just assumed it was suicide. But you're right. I mean, it might have been a legitimate try to swim for shore.
He dives into the water. I'm pretty sure.
You're right.
Yeah. When I first saw it, I immediately thought suicide. And I think that shot's in the trailer as well.
Yeah, it is.
And again, we've got that absurdity and that meaninglessness. And there's no hope. There's no answer. I might as well take my own life, or get picked off on the beach. But maybe this guy actually had enough hope to think, I'm not waiting any longer. I'm going to try.
It could have also been like, well, I'm going to die here anyway, right. And I'm probably not going to get on one of those boats because I'm so far back. So if I'm going to die, I might as well at least, give it a shot.
Exactly. And I think that's what I took away. I'm not necessarily giving up, but he must have known somewhere that the water was probably too cold, and 21 miles or whatever it is a long way to swim.
Yeah, he'll get too tired.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because thinking about it, that's actually a testament to the film too, because what have we been talking about? We've been talking about where is there hope? And in some ways, I think what you've got there is really how you read the film can read that moment. There's an ambiguity that's actually really good that is ambiguous. We don't know anything about the guy. He gets into the water, but you've got some characters that are there that are waiting for, and they use the term miracle. They're waiting for an act of God. Literally, that's what a miracle is. And there are others that have completely given up. And so much of perspective comes to what are you clinging to in terms of hope? This particular film, we see that, Churchill said he was supposed to get 30,000 men off the beach, but he's really sort of abandoned them. Kenneth Branagh's character is not impressed that he has pulled back the ships, but he also understands because he knows the military protocol. And he says, well, they've activated to see if any civilians will come and do it. But the military's basically left them there on the beach. Like, it's over. But
they were saving the ships and the planes for what they believed was the next stage of the attack, which was going to be the Navy and the military and the Air Force attacking Britain, right? Full arm.
Sure. Yeah.
Full-scale assault.
The bigger battle or the next battle, I think they say. And you look at this one individual diving into the ocean, and it is, I'd never occurred to me before this moment that so much of reading that scene stems from what is your view of hope? Some people view it as, a pipe dream, as like, okay, it's just believing in nothing and hoping for the best. And some really do believe that God is at work, or that there is something that you can look towards, or if I take this step out, in an act of faith, and maybe I can make those, 20 miles or however long it is, if it's better than staying here. But honestly,
well, and this is what being truly human is all about. It seems to me that,
yeah,
this act of faith, this act of decision making that we all do each and every day. And it brings me back to George, this profoundly, what appeared to be at the time insignificant decision that he made that ultimately led to a whole slew of other events and certainly changed his life and his family's life and everyone on the boat, really, I would imagine. Think about the reunion when they get together, the article in the newspaper and so on. But these simple acts of faith, that these leaps of faith that we all take every day with our families and our friends and our teachers and our and employers and colleagues and pastors, Steve, and all that, yeah. How does it all play out? We don't really know. Oh, this is the beauty of it all. And yet the absurdity as well,
I was wondering how you two felt about Cillian Murphy's, obviously, certainly his character, but the decision to sort of let him off the hook at the end. It's an interesting moment in the film where he asks if George is all right when he's clearly being dragged out in a stretcher. Or I guess that hadn't happened yet, but he asks if the boy's all right, and the son says he'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering how you felt about that moment.
I think that there was something in between the father and the son where the son was just sort of like, this guy is crazy, we need to do something about him. And the father understood the fact that he had some serious PTSD going on. You just can't push him, Mm-hmm. So I think that by the end of it, the son had sort of understood from the father, unspoken he's messed up from the war. There's nothing that, no good will come from telling him that George is dead, because it will probably just mess him up more. Mm. Yeah.
To me, that was a real moment of grace. Like, that was a true moment of grace in the film, because, you know, that son could have absolutely lost it on him and said, you know, look what you've done. But instead, they release him. And
well, and there's a shift in the son's character as well, because, or at least in the way he experiences it, because about halfway through that experience, he's quite angry with him as well.
Yeah, yeah.
That's before we know that George, you know, ultimately is going to die. I actually saw George as being kind of the catalyst for Murphy, Cillian Murphy's character's kind of on-site healing, if you will, because he eventually throws off the blanket and gets involved.
Hmm.
Right. Huh. He starts pulling people out of the water. He's not fully human again, because the shell shock of it all and the trauma is going to affect him for the rest of his life. But I think, Julie, you're absolutely right that Mark Rylance's character, he understood in a way that his son couldn't. I mean, I think he even taps him on the back at the end, and this is after he knows that George has died. This is war. This is the madness of it all. But at least we have each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting too, the way that the son reacted when he finally found out that George was dead. Or I think it was Harry Styles who said he's dead.
Hmm.
The son didn't really even bat an eye. He was just like, then be careful of him.
That's right.
It was so understated and very intriguing to see how he acted.
Yeah, you could see that. You're right. I think that his character certainly changes throughout the film, but still sort of maintains his core. I don't know how to describe it. Like, his character doesn't wildly change, but he grows
that's
up.
Right. Yeah.
He right. grows up. Maybe that's the way to describe it. And all they did was go across the channel. But he sees a lot in that amount of time. I also wondered too, you know, it's funny, they talk about the way that he plays with time throughout the film. And I thought it was interesting that by establishing different sets of time, so start with a week, a day, and an hour, the interesting thing about that to me was that for that pilot, the hour is like a week.
Right.
You know, for those fishermen, that day is like the week. It is not... Even though the timing is smaller, it is actually just as long and just as difficult.
What's so beautiful too is how each one of these perspectives, and I think that's largely what it's about, is you know, seeing this situation, seeing this war from all these different perspectives. It's so beautifully interwoven together. It's almost, you know, again, a reminder that there's an interdependence to all of this. We're all in this together. Everything we do affects somebody else. You know, the decisions we make, are we going to plug the holes in the boat as they start to appear? Or, you know, how are we actually going to do our part? Or are we going to sit in the boat covered in a blanket, you know, and disconnect and disengage. Yeah, I just thought of another sort of hopeful scene as well, after one of the ships is torpedoed and going down, and I guess so many of the men and women on the ship ultimately drowned, but we're wondering if, you know, our main characters are going to get out, and the I think it's the French soldier who comes back, opens the door, and there's a beautiful scene where Nolan shoots it from inside the ship, and the light, it's kind of like the light at the end of the tunnel. When he opens the door, we see this beam of light come in, and they all swim towards the light. Yeah, you know what? The more I think about it, the more hopeful I think this film is. As crazy as that sounds.
I was thinking the same thing in this conversation. I don't know how you've done it. You've done some sort of witchcraft on me.
That's right. It's voodoo, Steve.
I'm like, I came out of this film and I thought, man, all I could think about was the darkness and the beatings that these men went through, and how escaping was hope in and of itself. But yeah, there are these sort of moments where light breaks through, and, you know, it's funny, they're waiting for the big miracle, but there are so many little miracles throughout the film.
There you go. That's it, man. It's the little things making a big difference. It's everybody, everything we do matters. you know, which is interesting. Mark Rylance was in Bridge of Spies, and that's ultimately the message in that film as well, right? I mean, isn't it the line, every individual matters? Or isn't that Tom Hanks's line in that film, right? I think it's I love this celebration of our beautifully tragic the sense of humanity in Dunkirk. I really do. I can't wait to see it again, and I'm gonna go see it in 70mm for sure.
I can't wait till it's available for digital download so I can watch it on my iPad with my headphones in. So excited.
And make sure you watch it outside, so that, you know, you don't get any of the effect of the light, even on the iPad, right? distorted as much as
you can. That's right, in the summertime exactly.
Yeah, wear sunglasses too, you know.
It's how Nolan intended it, let's be serious. <That's right.
laughs> It's a beautiful thing.
This seems like actually a good place for us to start wrapping up, so why don't we do Screen It or Skip It? Dunkirk, Screen It or Skip It. I don't even want to ask David
whether skip it.
I assume, David, it's a screen it with you.
Hey, capital S.
Julie?
Total screen it. You have to go see it on the big screen. Go do the IMAX 70mm. This movie, and it's hilarious because I liked it from the start. But the more and more we talk about it, the more we break it down, the more I fall in love with it. And the more, I mean, yeah, David, you've been like totally convincing me to go see it again, because I feel like there's so much more I can choose from it. Or not choose, sorry, take from it.
Sure.
Christopher Nolan totally hit the nail on the head with this one. There's everything from the sound, the way that they played with light. Oh, so many messages. The acting was phenomenal. Understated, but phenomenal. You know what I mean? Like, there was so many different elements that just came together flawlessly.
Do you know, you just, I just, I, can, Steve, can I take another minute here?
Go right ahead.
So when I, after seeing the film, I started doing some research on the history of it and, you know, what happened and so on. And there's obviously a lot of images from the time. And there's one really iconic image, it seems, because it appeared in quite a few different places, of a soldier who knows, could be Canadian, could be British, could be an Indian, on the shore shooting up with his 303. And it's really, you got to find the photo. I'll see if I can find it and send it to you guys. Well, Nolan actually tries to represent that in the film when we see the first dive bomber coming in. There's one guy. Do you remember this?
Yes.
Well, how audacious can you be? I mean, talk about a license to an act of suicide. And yet he was hopeful enough that I think I can get this guy. I think I can bring him down and save the lives of my friends, right? Mm. Of the guys that I'm fighting this battle with. It just hit me, Julie, as you were talking about that. It's I'm going to see it again, man.
I don't know how you guys did this. I I was positive on the film, but I was closer to lukewarm. But you're right. The more we talk about the subtext, I'm actually, this has really swayed me, and I feel like I have to see it again.
Nice.
I don't know how you did that. But
it's only done about $350 million at the box office, so they could probably use your $12
That's
more
right.
dollars.
That's right. So funny. You're sending me to IMAX, man. That's like $25, all right?
Hey, listen, Steve, I feel so strongly about it, I'll pay the extra. How's that?
There it is. Okay, you heard it here on the podcast. Yes. Well, in all honesty, I don't know if I would say it was Nolan's best film, but it certainly is in the conversation. And I think that it is Nolan's best shot film and maybe his best written film in so many ways, because he's pulled back on a lot of the things that he normally tries to push forward in a way that actually helps the film. And I'm calling it. I don't know if I'm right or if I'm wrong. I'm going to call it that he finally wins his best director, because I think that so many people want an excuse to give Christopher Nolan his best director film, and they've never had a real chance, because nobody was going to nominate The Dark Knight. Nobody's going to nominate a film like Interstellar or Inception, regardless about how you see the film. Those films just don't win very often. And But war films, it's been a long time since we've seen a war film that has struck as many chords as this one. So I will be very interested. I will guarantee you a nomination, but I think this could be his year. It really could be an interesting moment come March, next March.
Mm, I hope it goes on. I'm certainly going to be nominated for lots, and I hope it goes on to win a ton of awards.
Absolutely. Guys, thank you so much for being on. This has been a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking with you both. Let's start with you, David. Is there a way that our listeners could connect with you?
Yes, yeah, so, I guess. Yeah, thanks. And I enjoyed it too. Really, thanks for inviting me on, Julie. It's been great. And I wouldn't have known you had a cold, by the way, if you hadn't said anything. Yeah. So really appreciate you making me a part of this conversation. Face2facelive.ca is the podcast, and I think we just published about our 310th interview. Wow. And it was with Chris Kelly and his new film, A Cambodian Spring, which is a remarkable documentary about, you know, Cambodia and about some of the things going on there. And it was really funny. It took us forever to actually land it and finally connect, about 2.5-3 months. And he's doing the film festival circuit right now. And just a real testament to, again, the power of the individual, the power of the little things making a big difference. So I recommend you guys seeing it. But yeah, face2facelive.ca, and you can reach me probably through there or my own personal site, davidpecklive.com. That's another way to get a hold of me.
Great. And Julie, thanks so much for coming back on. I love chatting with you. You know that.
Thank you. It's been awesome. I love it.
We're excited too, because we're gearing up for Toronto International Film Festival. So hopefully you'll be hearing a lot from Julie and I and David as that incredible drug that is the Toronto International Film Festival. So, of course, Julie, are you on Twitter? Do people want to follow you on Twitter?
Oh, no. Screenfish does have an Instagram, though.
Oh, yes. Yes, we do. Woo-hoo. That's right. I forgot about that. So you can follow us there as well. To our listeners at home, again, reminder, you can find us on SoundCloud, Podomatic, iTunes, and Stitcher. If you go to the website, screenfish.net, and download and go to the podcast page, you can download Fishing for More, which is small group questions that you can have when you see Dunkirk in 70mm at the IMAX theater, as you have been instructed.
Absolutely.
Threatened, in fact.
It's an outrage if you see it in any other way.
And, of course, the podcast will be back with our season finale. We will be coming back with our final episode on Catherine Bigelow's Detroit. And after that, we will shift gears a little bit. There'll be a little bit of a break. And hopefully, God willing, we will have some great stuff for you during the film festival this year as well. So once again, guys, thank you so much for talking. It's been just a blast to talk to you about such a powerful film.
Thanks for having
Steve.
Me.
Yeah.
Thanks, Steve.
And as always, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.